So what we're going to be doing here today is we're going to be taking a look at a sugya that talks about davening, and there are two parallel sugyot, okay? One in the Bavli and the other in the Yerushalmi. And we're going to try to look closely at the sugya, at its structure, and especially at the agadic part of the sugya, to try to see what the significance of the Agadah is in this halachic sugya, okay? Why, what the Agadah does there, and why it was put there, and what's the role of the Agadah in this halachic sugya, because it's a sugya that deals with a halachic issue, okay? And we're going to compare the sugya in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi to see if they're the same or if there's a different message in each of them. So we start with the Mishnah. This is the Mishnah in Masechet Brachot in the fifth chapter. Okay, the first Mishnah there. And it's talking about tefillah, about davening. And it says, one should not stand up to pray save in a reverent frame of mind, which means in Hebrew it says, Bekoved Rosh. Okay, a person should only pray if he is Bekoved Rosh. And then the next sentence in the Mishnah says, the pious men of old, okay, which in Hebrew are called the Hasidim Arishonim, used to wait an hour before praying in order that they may concentrate their thoughts upon their Father in heaven. Okay, so we're told here this is not an instruction, it's not a halacha, it's just telling us something, some information. It's saying that the Hasidim Arishonim used to wait an hour before praying so that they could concentrate their thoughts. And then the third sentence in the Mishnah is al halacha, it's an instruction. It says, even if a king greets him while praying, he should not answer him. And even if a snake is wound, I'm sorry about the mistake here, the spelling mistake, it should be wound around his heel, he should not interrupt his prayer. Okay, so that's the third part of the Mishnah. Now, this third part of the Mishnah is very interesting. First of all, it gives us a very powerful message about prayer. Right, it's saying that if a person is praying, then he shouldn't stop, okay, under any condition. Nothing can stop him from praying, even if there's a snake, even if it's dangerous, if there's a real danger there. Okay, it seems to imply that even if there's a pikuach nefesh, even if there's danger, there's a snake wound around his heel, or a king greeting him, and we know we're not talking about just Queen Elizabeth here. We're talking about a king that, if he greets you and you don't salute right away, then you're in big trouble, and you're probably not going to get home that day or any day for that matter. And so, even if this danger is there, you cannot stop praying, okay? You do not interrupt your prayer no matter what. That's what this sentence in the Mishnah seems to imply. But there's a difficulty with it, right? Because we know that pikuach nefesh is only, you're only supposed to give your life for three transgressions, three averot that you should not perform, even if it's in the cost of your life. We know murder and adultery, and avodah zarah, right, and idol worship, right? So, and prayer is not one of them, okay? Stopping in the middle of prayer is not one of them. So this already seems a bit strange when we read it. But nevertheless, this is what Rebbe is saying here in the Mishnah. He's saying that that's the case. Even if there is a danger here, even if there's a snake there or a king there, you may not interrupt your prayer. So some tried to answer this question and interpret this Mishnah a bit differently by saying that the third sentence is actually connected to the second one. It's not an instruction for everyone. It's something that only those Hasidim Arishonim, it's actually saying they used to wait an hour before praying so that they could concentrate their thoughts. And then, even if a king greets him, that's part of the description of the way that they did things, the Hasidim Arishonim. So even if a king greeted them or a snake was there, they didn't stop. However, this doesn't work so well in the Mishnah, because if you look at the wording, so the sentence, the middle sentence, that's talking about the Chassidim HaRishonim, is in the plural, right? It says, they used to wait an hour before praying. And the third sentence is in the singular, right? It says, even if a king greets him while praying, he should not answer. Even a snake is wound around his heel, he should not interrupt his prayer. So obviously, it doesn't look like the pshat here in the Mishnah to say that this is just describing what the Chassidim HaRishonim did. It looks as if it's an instruction, a halacha meant for everybody. Okay? So that's the Mishnah. However, when we start reading in the Gemara, we see that it's more complicated than that. And the Gemara, right away, when it relates to this third sentence in the Mishnah, the first thing that it does is to say, wait a minute, you didn't understand this correctly. Rav Yosef said, this was meant to apply only to Jewish kings, but for a Gentile king, he may interrupt. When you read in the Mishnah that even if a king greets you, you cannot interrupt your prayer, that's talking about a Jewish king. And a Jewish king, if you were praying and you didn't greet him, okay, he won't kill you. But if it's a Gentile king and there's a real danger there to your life, so of course you should interrupt your prayer, and you're not supposed to give up your life in order to not interrupt your praying. Okay, so that's Rav Yosef right away, straight away, that's what he says. Okay, so on one hand, he's actually saying that the normative instruction, okay, what we're really supposed to do is not to risk our lives for prayer. Okay, on the other hand, of course, when you read this, then the very powerful message of the Mishnah about what prayer means is weakened, right? It's not the same impression that we get about prayer than we got from the Mishnah. Basically, this interpretation, this way that he interpreted the Mishnah, more or less, I would say, got rid of the whole powerful feeling that we had in the Mishnah, how powerful, how important prayer is. Okay, so he's saying, actually, no, it's not like that. And if there's a real danger there, you shouldn't interrupt your prayer. You should interrupt your prayer, and you shouldn't risk your life. But that's not the end of the sugya. If we continue, so I skipped a little. There's a little objection raised in the Gemara, but I'll skip that right now. Okay, it's not very important. And then the sugya ends with a story. And the story goes like this. Our rabbis taught, it is related that once when a certain chassid was praying by the roadside, an officer came by, a Gentile officer, and greeted him, and he did not return his greeting. So he waited for him until he finished his prayer. Now that's very generous. How many Roman soldiers or officers do you know that would do that? But anyway, he waited for him. When he had finished his prayer, he said to him, "Fool, is it not written in your law, in the Torah, only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently?" All right, in the Torah it says that you should take care of your soul. And also written, take ye therefore good heed unto your souls. In Hebrew it's known as v'nishmartem me'od nefshotechem, okay? You're supposed to take care of your life. You're not supposed to just throw it away, okay? And if there's a danger, so you do what you do in order to preserve your life. You don't continue praying. When I greeted you, why did you not return my greeting? If I had cut off your head with my sword, who would have demanded your blood from me? So the Chassid doesn't seem to be really bothered by this. He replied to him calmly, yeah, wait until I appease you with words. Wait a minute, not so fast. Let's have a little schmooze here, and then we'll see what we do. If, he went on, you had been standing before a mortal king, and your friend had come and given you greeting, would you have returned it? Okay, if you're standing before a mortal king. No, he replied. And if you had returned his greeting, what would they have done to you? They would have cut off my head with the sword, he replied. He then said to him, have we not here an a fortiori argument, a kal vachomer? If you would have behaved in this way when standing before an earthly king who is here today and tomorrow in the grave, how much more so I, when standing before the supreme king of kings, the holy one, blessed be he, who endures for all eternity? Okay, so that's his argument here. Forthwith, the officer was appeased, and the Chassid departed to his home in peace. And the Hebrew word for departed here is niftar leveito B'shalom. Okay, I'm going to mention that later, why the significance of this, okay? So what we see here in this story is that what does the Hasid do? He actually risks his life and he doesn't interrupt his prayer. So now I'm confused. What's the message of the sugya? It begins by reinterpreting the Mishnah in a way that says that you're absolutely not supposed to risk your life for prayer, and you should interrupt your prayer. On the other hand, the end note of the sugya, right? The bottom line is this story that shows this Hasid who actually does risk his life. So what is the sugya trying to tell us with this zigzag here? Okay, there's something not exactly clear here. What you're supposed to do? So I think it's okay. It's pretty clear that there's a difference between most people, and the halacha is for everybody that you should not interrupt your prayer. You should not risk your life. Right, but there's the Hasid, who's like a different entity. But why is the structure of the sugya built like this? Okay, why does it start with the normative instruction for everyone, and then end with the story of the Hasid, which is very strong, right? It's very powerful. This message stays with us. In order to try to see what's going on here, I want to take a look at the parallel in the Yerushalmi. Okay, the parallel in the Yerushalmi is very similar, it appears. Take a look, please, at source 6. Okay, Yerushalmi Brachot. It's on page 3. And it says there, Rabbi Yochanan, I see, I see that there's a little part missing here for some reason, so I'll just tell you what it says. The sugya in the Yerushalmi begins the same way that the Bavli does. The first thing the sugya says, a rabbi says, you have to reinterpret the Mishnah. The Mishnah doesn't really mean that if a king greets you, if he's a Gentile king, you should not answer him. On the contrary, if he's a Gentile king, okay, you should answer him and interrupt your prayer. If it's a Jewish king, you can keep on praying. So it again differentiates between a real situation of a life-endangering situation and a situation where there isn't a real danger there, and then you should not interrupt your prayer. And then it brings the story, okay, and I'm reading here. Rabbi Yochanan was sitting and reciting, and he may have been reciting the Shema, or he may have been reciting something from the Torah, but he's sitting and reciting in front of the Babylonian synagogue in Tzipori, okay, in Sepphoris. A governor passed, a Roman governor, and he did not rise before him. Okay, so they, meaning the people escorting the governor, his soldiers around him, came and wanted to strike him. They wanted to hit Rabbi Yochanan because he's not giving the proper honor to this governor. Okay, he's continuing to recite, and he's not standing up in front of him like he should. So the governor said to them, "Leave him alone, for he's occupied with the law of his creator." Okay, so here the governor says, "Don't hit him. Don't do anything to him. He's occupied with the law of his creator, and he respects that." And nothing happens to Rabbi Yochanan. Okay, so again, we see the same structure in the Yerushalmi. The same, it begins with the part that doesn't appear here, that's missing here, which actually reinterprets the Mishnah and says the correct interpretation is, and the normative instruction is not to endanger your life, but not to put your life in danger, but to interrupt your prayer. But afterwards, there's a story that sort of contradicts that, right? It's going in the opposite direction. You're right. In which direction is it going? What do you think? Is it stronger when it's the Shema or when it's Shemoneh Esrei? Yeah, but in the Mishnah in Brachot says that the Shema you're allowed, even the Mishnah says that the Shema you're allowed to interrupt, and in the davening it says in this Mishnah you're not allowed. Why is that? it's true that it's because of, it's true that it's midaraisa, but the, on the other hand, in the Shema, you're not standing before God and speaking to Him. You're reciting something. Okay? Yeah, that's right. Okay, so the structure is similar, but the story is not exactly the same story. Okay, and the Yerushalmi, which is earlier, I think has the original story, and that's Rabbi Yochanan, and it's a short account of Rabbi Yochanan just sitting and reciting, and his life is spared, right? Nothing happens to him. The story in the Bavli is much longer, it's more elaborate, and I think it has a different message as well. If you take a look in the story in the Bavli, we'll see that a few pages before that in the Bavli, we find a different story that has some similar words that are similar to the story of the Chassid. And take a look at page 2, at the top of page 2, in source 3 there. So, absolutely not. It is not clear, and on the contrary, we'll soon see that maybe that's exactly the point.
Besides, the Roman or whatever it is here is respectful and understanding, whereas the first one in the Bavli is not.
Well, in the end, he is. I mean, first of all, he waited for him until he finished praying. Then he reprimanded him. And by the way, he not only was a generous person, he was a Talmud Chacham as well. He's reciting Psukim from Sefer Dvarim, right? He knows this, and he's also in the end, he lets him go. He accepts his argument, and he lets him go. So they're both pretty understanding. Okay, let's take a look at this story at Brachot 28b. When Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai fell ill, his disciples went in to visit him. When he saw them, he began to weep. His disciples said to him, Lamp of Israel, pillar of the right hand, mighty hammer, why do you weep? Okay. So he replied, if I were being brought today before a mortal king who is here today and tomorrow in the grave. Okay, that strikes a bell, right? These words here. Whose anger, if he's angry with me, does not last forever. If he imprisons me, does not imprison me forever. And who, if he puts me to death, does not put me to everlasting death. And whom I can appease with words and bribe with money. Even so, I would weep. Now that I am being brought before the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be he who lives and endures for all eternity, whose anger, if he is angry with me, is an everlasting anger. Who, if he imprisons me forever. Who, if he puts me to death forever. And who I cannot appease with words or bribe with money. And what's more, but there are two ways before me, one leading to paradise and the other to hell. And I do not know by which I shall be taken. Shall I not weep? And then they said to him, Master, bless us. He said to them, may it be God's will that the fear of heaven shall be upon you like the fear of flesh and blood. So his disciples said to him, is that all? The fear of heaven should be only like the fear of flesh and blood? Shouldn't it be more? So he said to them, you know, if you did that, then that's a lot. He said to them, if only you can attain this, okay? You can see, for when a man wants to commit a transgression, he says, I hope no man will see me. Okay, so he doesn't fear God. God is seeing him wherever he is. But he looks around to see that nobody's looking, the people around him. Okay, at the moment of his departure, and in Hebrew it's bishat petirato, he said to them, remove the vessels so that they should not become unclean, and prepare a throne for Hezekiah, the king of Judah, who is coming. Now, I brought a chart here at the bottom of the page that compares the two stories, and you see they're very similar words and sentences in both of them. Okay, they both contain the first line here, before a mortal king, I'm being brought before a mortal king who is here today and tomorrow in the grave. And the Hasid asks the officer, right? He's saying to him, if you were standing before a mortal king who is here today and tomorrow in the grave. And what's more, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai also says that a mortal king is one which he can appease with words, right? And whom I can appease with words. And in the story of the Hasid, the Hasid tells the officer, wait until I appease you with words. Okay, so this is like very similar. And also the sentence saying, before the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be he who lives and endures for all eternity, and whom I cannot appease with words. Okay, so that's in both stories. And in the story of the Hasid, we read in the end that indeed, forthwith the officer was appeased, right? He was appeased with words. And the Hasid departed to his home in peace. He was niftar to his home in peace. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he was niftar in a different way, right? Also to a different place, I assume to a good place in peace as well. But we have the similar word here, which connects the two stories. So what I think is like this. I think the Yerushalmi is earlier, and I think that the Bavli retains the same structure of the sugya as the Yerushalmi, but it chooses to bring a different story. And I think, if I can guess, that it constructs a new story, okay, using the motif from the story in the Yerushalmi, but telling it a bit differently, and it uses some of its some of the words that it uses are taken from the story of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and it creates this story about the Hasid. Why? Because it wants to convey a different message. What's the message of the story in the Yerushalmi? Rabbi Yochanan is sitting there, he's reciting, and I think, like this gentleman has said, he does not realize what's going on. He has no clue. He's immersed in what he's doing, right? He's busy, and he's reciting. Probably his eyes were closed or whatever, and he doesn't know what almost hit him, right? He doesn't know. He has no idea. They pass before him. He doesn't stand up. They want to hit him. The guy tells him, don't hit him, leave him alone. And they go on. He may have not have known.
Right.
His eyelids were very long, and they had to lift them with, that's true.
Maybe other places where Rabbi Yochanan's eyes may have been, closed.
Okay, so I agree. So what we see here is that in this story, Rabbi Yochanan doesn't realize what's happening. But in the story in the Bavli of the Hasid, it's very different. The Hasid is well aware of what's happening. And we know, and it's not that he's so immersed in his prayer that he doesn't even notice that this officer is waiting for him. He actually makes a conscious decision. Okay, he decides that he's going to continue praying. Why? Because he's standing before the King of Kings, before Melech Melchei HaMelechim, before Kadosh Baruch Hu. So he can't interrupt his prayer. And we see this from what he asks the officer. He says to him, if you were standing in front of the mortal king, and your friend came and started talking to you, would you answer him? No. Now, if you're standing before a mortal king and your friend's talking, you're aware of the fact that your friend is there, but you consciously decide that you're not going to interrupt your discussion with the king, right? Because you don't want, it's disrespectful towards the king, and you don't want the king to kill you. So the same goes for the Hasid himself. He was standing in front of God, and the message here is a bit different. It's not just praying and being immersed in your prayer, so concentrated that you don't realize what's going on. On the contrary, you realize what's going on and you make a decision. And your decision is not to interrupt what you're doing, to be respectful towards God and not towards the person who's greeting you, who just came there. So, and I think the Bavli wanted to create it like this. We see that this idea, this theme of standing before God and the respect that you have to have, the yirah that you have to have for God, is very strong in the story of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. That's the message there, that he's saying there, I fear God, I'm about to appear before him in heaven, and that's why I'm so afraid. And he's a king, he's not just a mortal king, he's a much bigger king. And the way he describes him, which reappears in the Hasid story, and the whole idea that he says later on that what I really want is for people to fear God, at least the way that they fear people. Okay, so the topic, the theme in these sugiyot is the fear of God and the way we respect him like such a high king. Very interestingly, if we continue to the second part of the sugya, we see the same phenomenon. Go back to page one, please. No, not page one. Sorry, page three. And here we have the second part of the sugya. And in this second part, the sugya is relating to the last sentence in the Mishnah again, to the second part of that sentence. In that sentence, it said, if you just take a peek here on page one, even if a snake is wound round his heel, he should not interrupt his prayer. Okay, so the Gemara is relating to that, and it does the same thing that it did in the first part, in the previous part. Rav Sheshet said, this applies only in the case of a serpent or a snake. But if it's a scorpion, he breaks off, which means that if it's a scorpion on your heel, you should interrupt your prayer. Okay, and I'm not an expert on all these reptiles and all these nice creatures, and I don't know how it works, but the Gemara is implying here that there's a difference between a snake. Even if a snake is wound around your heel, he will not necessarily bite you. And I think we know today that if you stand perfectly still, which you're supposed to be doing anyway while you're, you could be in davening, you could be shuckling, so that's not, but if there's a snake there, you shouldn't shuckle, you should stand still. But if you stand still, the snake may leave you alone. It won't necessarily bite you. But if it's a scorpion, so the Gemara says that he will strike you again and again, and you don't have a choice. It's a real danger, and you have to interrupt your prayer and run away or something. I think you're right, but I think the point here is not the important point here is not the realistic aspect. It's the point that they're trying to make. The idea is that they're interpreting the Mishnah in such a way that you don't have to put your life in danger. Okay, if you're praying, then if it's a real danger, you're allowed to interrupt your prayer and to to climb on a chair or something and do something to save your life. Or call someone quick. But if it's not a real danger, then you don't interrupt your prayer. Okay?
Let me face the fact that if we're talking about Hasid, then we'll go back to the first Mishnah.
Okay.
He's somebody who spent an hour, as it were hours, Lav Davka, spent a lot of time concentrating before he even daven. So he's steeled himself to anything like this. He is concentrated. He has concentrated. He isn't somebody who's going to jump up and down. In other words, he's prepared himself for any eventuality, and he's coming to this conjunction with. On the other hand, if it's something that's going to strike you again and again, that's another story. That he has to, you have to be a realist.
Okay, and what would you think the Hasid would do if it was a scorpion?
No, that's what Chazal is saying. The scorpion, you know, will bite you again and again. You better. You better. That's all part of your preparation.
Okay, but what would the Hasid do? What you're saying is that's the halacha for everybody. That's what we should do. Okay, but if we look at the story of the Hasid, we'll see in a minute. He may act differently. Okay, he may choose to act differently. Right, the three cardinal sins, transgressions, yes. That's a good question. I think it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly at what point in history this decision was made. But if you look at the sources, then it appears that, so this decision that it's only for the three cardinal sins that you risk your life, that you give your life, it appears in Tanaitic sources. So it appears in Tanaitic sources. Yes, in Tanaim. It appears, I don't remember if it's in the Tosefta or in one of the Midrashei Halacha, but it does appear in a Tanaitic source. So we could try. Okay, we have to look it up. I have to look it up too. But if I recall correctly, it does appear in a Tanaitic source. So apparently, Rebbe, when he redacts the Mishnah, could have been aware of it at least. Okay, so but you know what? I'll even if we say that it was later. Okay, so fine. So Rebbe may have really meant to say that you should risk your life, but the Gemara has to already take into account this decision that you don't risk your life for anything except for those three cardinal sins. So maybe that's why the Gemara is moved to reinterpret the Mishnah in a way that the halacha will be that you don't have to risk your life. Okay, and it's creative interpretation of the Mishnah. Okay, but since the Mishnah can suffer this interpretation, can contain it, then that's what the Gemara actually does. And what the Gemara is really doing here, it's in the first stage of the sugya, it's saying what the normative thing should be for most people. Okay, and only in the end it's bringing a different type of behavior for the Hasid. If we go back, but that's a good point. Thank you. If we go back to the source 5 here, okay, so we saw that the second part of the sugya, about the snake or the serpent, Rav Sheshet said, this applies only in the case of a serpent. But if it is a scorpion, he breaks off. And then the Gemara continues. You see, I skipped a few lines here because, again, the Gemara, I'm not hiding anything from you here. It's just the Gemara continues. It brings an objection from a Braita, and it answers it. Okay, it stays, the decision stays the same. Okay, the halacha stays the same. The normative decision of the Gemara is that you do not have to risk your life. Okay, that's the whole halachic discussion. Remains with this decision. It doesn't change it. But after that, we find again here a story. Our rabbis taught, in a certain place, there was once a reptile or a lizard. I think the actual word in the Gemara is, could read it arod or arvad. It's ayin resh vav dalet. Okay, it's not exactly clear how to pronounce it. And especially, you have to be aware of the fact that it's confusing because there are two different creatures. One is an arod, which is sort of a mixture between a horse and a donkey. And that was a dangerous creature, but that's not the creature it's talking about here. That's another dangerous creature. You don't want to meet him on the street anywhere because he was very violent and dangerous. Okay, that's one creature. The other creature is, again, the creature called something Ayin Resh Vav Dalet, but in this case, it's not like a donkey or a horse. It's a reptile. It's a type of poisonous reptile. Okay, a lizard, a poisonous lizard. And the story says, in a certain place, there was once such a creature which used to injure people. So they came and told Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Okay, so this is at the time of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, and Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was a figure of a Hasid. It was a type. It was one of these Hasidim. Okay, so he said to them, "Show me its hole." They showed him its hole. Okay, so they took him to the hole in the ground of that reptile. Okay, so I would expect that he would try and spray it with something. But instead, and he put his heel over the hole. Okay, he just puts his heel inside the hole. And okay, so what's going to happen? Is he just going to stand there for days now just not to let it out or something? But then it says that it came out and bit him. And I guess he expected that. That was his plan. And it died. The reptile died, not Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. It bit him and he died. And it died. Okay? And he didn't die. And what did he do next? He put it on his shoulder and brought it to the Beit HaMidrash. Which is a very interesting thought, okay? Just think about that. Imagine that, the Rosh Yeshiva coming into the Beis Medrash with a crocodile or something on his shoulder. I'm sure today students would appreciate that.
As long as it's dead.
As long as it's dead, yeah, okay. What, because of the, oh yeah, if it's wound up around his arm, yeah. Maybe he did that, I don't know. It's a... No, it says it's on his shoulder. So he comes to the Beit HaMidrash and said to them, "See, my sons, it is not the reptile or lizard that kills, it is sin that kills." Okay? So it's not this reptile, which was dangerous and kept killing people. It's not the power of the reptile. It's not the poison that really killed the people. It's their sins. And if you don't have any sins, then the reptile can't harm you, okay? And then he was trying to say to them, the way the world works is, you think you understand it, but it's not a natural way that you think things work, that just things bite you and you die because of they're poisonous. But it depends on if you're righteous, then it won't harm you. Yes.
How did he know that he has no sins whatsoever? Where did he get the chutzpah to think?
Okay, so, but he was a very righteous man.
You can't assume such a thing. Yeah, but that doesn't...
Yeah, that's true also. That's also said about him. Yeah, that's right. He had, what? Made him immune. Because people eat that. They buy them today in these special stores. They pay a lot of money for this. That's true.
Okay, all true, but still, how can you presume yourself that you're clean from sin?
Okay.
So there is a way. The way is, I think Reb Seira went into an oven to see if the oven would affect him or not.
Okay.
So maybe Reb Hanina had an oven, a special Hanina Mendoza oven.
Ah, so maybe he... So maybe he made an experiment. He did an experiment in his at his house before he went to this reptile. He experimented with the oven. Okay. But how do you know that he could go in the oven and not be harmed? That's a big risk. Rabbi Zera, yeah.
But also we have the Midrash about Avram and why he's so worried after the battle with the four kings and the five kings, because he had a sense that he might have used up his merits.
Right.
And now he wouldn't be right. Allowed to proceed according to the Brachot.
Mm-hmm. How does Rabbi Hanina Mendoza have the confidence that he still has his merits? It's a good question. But obviously, he did. Yeah, you wanted to... is there a special app for...
He had a soul phone, not a soul phone.
Yeah.
Soul phone.
Okay.
I wasn't aware of the thank you. Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Don't take this literally, but you had before Marseille got Siman Lebanim.
Right.
It would be a way of sending your rabbi today and, going to the hole of the reptile. Okay.
Well, not necessarily, but I think there's a big differentiation in Chazal between rabbis and Hasidim. So they're different types of people. And rabbis are rabbis. They know Torah. You're supposed to learn Torah from them. They're not supposed to do mafsim all the time. But chassidim, it's like chassidish rabbis. It's a different thing. In yeshiva, I guess, maybe you wouldn't send the Rosh Yeshiva, but maybe you would try and send the mashgiach. You wouldn't send yours.
I would send mine.
You would. But you would hope that... I don't want to say. Oh, okay.
We'll send you. We're sure it'll be okay.
Anyway, so he walks into the Beit Midrash and explains that. On that occasion, they said, so the students reacted, they said, "Woe to the man whom a reptile or lizard meets, but woe to the reptile which Rabbi Hanina Mendoza meets." Okay, so if you're a reptile, if you're a snake or whatever, you don't want to meet a person like Rabbi Chaim Mendoza. Okay, so that's the story in the Bavli. Now, if we look at the Yerushalmi, we find a parallel story, but it's not exactly the same, and that's very interesting. So take a look again at source 6 at the bottom part, and it says, at the second paragraph here. Okay, Rav Huna says, in the name of Rabbi Yossi, the Mishnah relates only to the case of a snake. However, if it is a scorpion, he stops praying since it strikes again and again. Okay, so that's the same thing that we saw in the Bavli. And then there's a story. It was told about Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa that he was standing and praying, and a certain poisonous reptile, and there it's called, in the Yerushalmi it's called a chabarbar, came and bit him. And he didn't interrupt his prayer. They went and found the reptile dead upon his hole. They said, woe to the man who a reptile bites, and woe to the reptile who bites Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. So he made his last mistake. What was the nature? And then the Gemara there in the Yerushalmi tries to explain a little bit about nature. What was the nature of this poisonous reptile? So this is very interesting. When he bites a man, then the race begins. If the man reaches water first, the reptile dies. And if the reptile reaches water first, the man dies. Okay, so again, I'm not an expert on zoology and about the and reptiles, and I couldn't find exactly to understand what kind of creature this is, so I don't know if this is how realistic this is. But this is this. I'm interested in the story here, okay, in the message of the story, and so what happened in this case of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa? How did it work? So we'll see that in a minute. So his disciples said to him, okay, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa's students, his disciples said to him, Rabbi, didn't you feel anything? Okay, this reptile bit you, and didn't you feel anything? He said, I swear that my heart was concentrated on prayer and I didn't feel anything. And then the Gemara ends with Rabbi Yitzchak ben Elazar said, God right away when he was bitten created a spring under his feet. Okay, so the miracle was Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was standing there praying. The reptile bit him and then God created a spring under his feet. So he reached the water first, right? So he was right in the water and then the reptile died. Okay, so that's the way it worked here. That's the mechanics of how it worked. Again, I don't exactly understand it, but I think the point of the story is more interesting. And I think the story here, again, like in Rabbi Yochanan, here it's even more explicit, right? Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa is not he's not deciding something consciously. He's unconscious. He doesn't know what's going around because he's praying. He's so immersed in his prayer that he doesn't even notice the reptile. He doesn't notice that it's there, and he doesn't even notice when it bites him, right? He's just in a different world. Okay, so this is very interesting, because now if we compare this with the Bavli, again, we see there's the same difference, that in the Bavli, they bring a different story about Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, but the story there is different. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa there takes a conscious decision to go and put his foot, his heel on the hole, right? It's not that he didn't notice it. It's not that he was in the middle of praying. He takes this decision, okay? Just like the Hasid in the previous story made a decision. He's praying and he's going to continue praying, okay? And why does Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa do it? Because he explains there that he thinks that what kills you in the end are your sins, not your not the poison of the snake or whatever it is, okay? So in both stories, we see there's this interesting difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, and I think that we can see this is a different approach to prayer, right? In the Yerushalmi, both figures, Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, when they're praying, they're so immersed in it, okay? They're concentrated on their prayer, and they're not aware of anything that's going on around them, okay? Whether it's a king or an officer that approaches them, or a snake or a reptile, whatever, they're just not aware of it, okay? And this is a specific approach to prayer. You can concentrate so hard on your prayer and be so immersed in it, you're not even aware of what's going on. Yeah.
Isn't that something unique to Judaism? It's more common in Buddhism. Herbert Benson from Harvard has stories that he's seen in the relaxation response where Buddhist monks have taken on freezing mountains and they gotten their body heat to the point where the sheets, wet sheets, dry out. You can change through focus that we don't have in the Western world.
Well, okay. Well, you see here that in the, I guess in the Yerushalmi here, in the, at least in the Roman world, in the Yerushalmi here, they had the same idea of prayer, at least in this sugya, the way it appears here. In both stories, you see that the idea is that you're immersed in it. There's also a Hasidish story about, I think it's about the Baal Shem Tov. I'm not sure, but I think they tell about him that every time that he went to Davin, he would before that go and say goodbye and farewell to his family because he never knew if he's coming back. He would ascend to heaven, right? It's about him, the Saraf, right? Okay, so he would go. So there's this Chassidus Rebbe again. He would be so concentrated, and I think it's even more. It's like a mystical experience, right? It's something mystic. The way you pray, it's a different type of prayer, okay, than most of us are acquainted with. But that's the type of prayer that's described here, I think. And whereas in the Bavli, I think they describe something different. It's not a prayer in which you're so immersed and you're not aware of anything. Okay, you're not disconnected from the world. You're praying and you're dafka aware of what's going on, and you know that this person is approaching you, and you decide that you're not going to stop and you're not going to interrupt your prayer. Okay, so in a certain sense, I think. Maybe you could see that as prayer. That's you're not ascending to a different world. You're not in a disconnecting from this world. You're still part of the world. Okay. Maybe it's something essential that the Bavli is trying to say about prayer. That maybe the Bavli wants you to be more connected to the world, and maybe wants your prayer to be more part of the world and not belonging to a different world. Okay. No. Okay, I'll just thank you for the question. I think it's an important point. I wasn't saying a general, I wasn't making a general statement about the Bavli and the Yerushalmi in general, okay? I was just saying in this specific sugya, okay? I'm very careful with this. I think in order to generalize, you really have to learn all the Bavli and all the Yerushalmi and see if this is consistent, and I'm not saying that. But in this specific sugya, I think, the redactors of the Yerushalmi, okay, the editors, chose a specific story and they put it in. And in this story, they did it twice. Okay, it's consistent in this sugya. Both with Rabbi Yochanan and with Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, they chose to tell a story in which the person who's praying is so immersed in it and he doesn't realize what's going on. Whereas the Bavli, they could have made the same decision as the Yerushalmi. Okay, I can't assure you 100% that they knew this sugya in the Yerushalmi, okay? Because we know today it's not 100% that they had the Yerushalmi as it is in front of us. But many of the traditions went to Babylonia and they were aware of. Okay, they may have been aware of this structure of the sugya in the Yerushalmi because the structure in the sugya in the Bavli is identical, exactly. And whether they were aware or not, their choice is a different choice than that of the Yerushalmi. And again, it's consistent. In both cases, the story is that the person is aware of what he's doing. He's not unaware of what's going on. He makes a conscious decision. Okay, so that's why I'm saying this. But again, I'll emphasize, and thank you for pointing that out, that this is not a general statement about Babylonia versus Eretz Yisrael or the Bavli versus the Yerushalmi. It's in this specific sugya that I see this. Okay?
Yeah, well, Chanina Dosa, in general, and the other Agadot about him and Shabbat, and he's living a life that's Lamala Min HaTeva.
Okay.
It's beyond nature.
Okay.
The kinds of things that he does, and he asks from heaven, and this and that, and the other. He's above nature. That's the simplest shot in how he can deal with Mazikim, like Arod and whatever it is.
Right.
Rabbi Yochanan, too, in Shari Tefillah, he's above the Ayin Hara, and his probably eyes were closed there as well. But, you know, when he appeared by the mikvahs. The one thing talking about General Bava Yerushalmi, there's less superstition, agodot, in the Yerushalmi than there are in the Bavli. At the same time, you see here the opposite, that here, this the first story is about somebody who's melumad benisim, okay, but this story about water first, second, third, that's straight superstition. And it's shocking that the Yerushalmi would actually take this seriously.
Okay. Okay.
Not only you don't know the story, the meaning of the story, nobody does.
Okay.
It's a kind of magical rather than, something that's in the religious area. It's complete magic, complete superstition.
Rabbi Turan was among the Rosh Yeshiva.
Which proves that they turn out after Carson, right?
Okay, so first of all, I apologize. I wasn't aware. I don't know. I didn't know you, but it's a privilege for me to discuss this with you.
Taking Rabbi Turan's point, it seems to me that there is a distinction between the two versions of the danger, and to me, the brachot, the presentation of brachot, is that there is, I would say, a natural science approach that says there's a way to escape the danger that is a natural science approach within the limited science and their understanding of what snakes did. The miraculous, or let's be cynical and say the superstitious aspect, is the fact that the miracle occurs, that the spring springs up at his feet to protect him. But that, I think, is different from the case that's presented in Brachot, where it's presented as if it is in the Bavli,
mm-hmm.
where it's presented as if the snake bites you, you're done, Bartik. And there is no protection that can save you in a natural science aspect.
Unless you're a tzaddik, right?
Unless you're right. Unless it's miraculous again.
Yeah. So. Okay, that's an interesting point. I'll just comment in the Yerushalmi, it's a combination because the spring there is something that God created there, right? Hashem created there as a miracle, so it is sort of combined. I just want to conclude by saying that trying to address the question why exactly the Bavli or why exactly this sugya was composed in such a structure. I think that on one hand, the sugya had no choice but to say that the halacha is the normative instruction is that you do not risk your life for prayer, and you interrupt your prayer. If it's a dangerous situation, you definitely interrupt your prayer. However, this takes away so much the powerful message of the Mishnah about the importance of prayer that I think that the sugya wanted to give us back some of this. So it does it by concluding the sugya with a story that is not the normative way for people. It's Hasidim. It's a different entity, maybe. It's a different type of people. It's the minority. It's not the way that most people should behave. But it does give a certain message, again, about the importance of prayer, especially the story about the Hasid, about the importance of prayer, about experience, the feeling of awe, the feeling of your awe that you should feel when you're praying that is so great that at least it should bother you if you're interrupting your prayer, and the Hasid chooses not to do it, and he succeeds also. He doesn't even pay the price for it. So, but that may be a special case of Hasidim. Thank you. If there are any other questions, I'll let you know.